This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is 7 months this week since Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, killing approximately 1,200 Israelis and taking more than 250 people hostage. Since then, Gaza health officials estimate the Israeli military has killed nearly 35,000 Palestinians in Gaza. Thousands more people are still buried underneath the rubble or missing. This week, the World Food Program's director, Cindy McCain, said this on NBC about Gaza.
What I can explain to you is that there is famine, full-blown famine in the north, and it's moving its way south.
Now, on Monday, Hamas said it approved a ceasefire proposal that included language which would make it permanent. Israel rejected that proposal. On that day, Israel launched additional airstrikes on the southern Gaza city of Rafah, where more than 1 million Palestinians have sought refuge. As of early last week, Hamas still held more than 130 of the hostages. That's where we are. And all of that, the Hamas attack and increasingly Israel's prosecution of its war in Gaza, have sparked international protests. Today, we are looking at those protests on college campuses, and specifically here. Now, it started with the protests at New York's Columbia University on April 17th, and then spread across the nation. Here, more than 200 student protesters have been arrested as of this morning at Emerson, Northeastern, and at Brandeis back in the fall, and just last night, UMass Amherst. Protest encampments remain at MIT and Harvard.
Free Palestine!
Where university officials have declared they must end, and that officials will and are taking disciplinary action against students. We will spend the whole hour on this subject, and we will begin with where we are at Harvard and MIT. WBUR's Max Larkin has been covering protests there, and Joe Lemon of the Harvard Crimson has been on the ground covering the Harvard Yard camps. Both are here in Studio 2. Joe Lemon, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you, and Max Larkin, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back.
All right, so I just want to start with where are we now? Max Larkin, let's have you focus on MIT, at least at the start. What do we know?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't simmered down at MIT. You had the camp go down briefly on Monday under the supervision of the Massachusetts State Police, but it was quickly reclaimed. And there's even been some escalation there, Tiziana, this morning. I guess a picket is ongoing on MIT's campus where the contested military research at the heart of this dispute is said to be happening. So, and meanwhile, the sort of sword of Damocles is hanging over students taking part in the protest, though we don't yet know exactly how that will play out.
What do you mean? Say a little more about the sword of Damocles, Max.
Well, there have been a succession of letters sent to people participating in the encampment that they are under threat of immediate academic suspension that would bar them from the last few days of classes, which end, I think, on May 16th, as well as from commencement activities for those who would be participating in those. And I think more seriously, they threaten to push those students out of dining halls and dorms, which would leave them, albeit only for a few days, without home housing or food.
Especially if they're not local.
Exactly.
Okay. And so, Joe, where are we now with Harvard's protest encampment?
Yeah. So there have been a couple of updates in the last couple of days. So Harvard Out of Occupied Palestine, which is an unrecognized student group, which is organizing the encampment.
And I'm sorry, just so I'm clear, an unrecognized student group or a formerly recognized? Is this a group that used to be recognized and isn't or has never been recognized?
So the Palestine Solidarity Committee was the main organizing group on campus. They are no longer recognized.
Okay.
This is a different group that's unrecognized.
Thank you. I'm going to be asking these little questions all the way through because there's so much, and we want to make sure we really understand exactly where we are. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, totally. So they set a deadline for 5 p.m. on Monday for administrators to start negotiating with the encampment about their demands. On Monday morning, Interim President Alan Garber sent an email out to the student body in which he said that students continuing the encampment would be subject to being placed on involuntary leave from the school, which could result in them not being able to sit for exams, for example, and not being able to return to campus. So on Monday at 5 p.m., the school had not started negotiating with the encampment, and the encampment had a press conference in which they said that 60 students were facing disciplinary action And then at 7 p.m., they held a rally in which they students as well as non-Harvard affiliates who they called on to join marched to the private residence of interim president Alan Garber, and they protested in front of his home. And then yesterday, students began refusing to submit to ID checks. So ID checks had been happening since the second day of the encampment. Essentially, administrators would come and students would present their IDs and have photographs taken of them or have them be scanned. And that was how the school was identifying who was at the encampment. But
and also, as I understand it, whether there was any, because the yard's supposed to be closed to anybody but members of the Harvard community.
Exactly. So everyone in the encampment is a Harvard affiliate, as far as we know. And the yard is currently closed to any non-Harvard affiliates. You have to scan your ID now to get in. So then yesterday, members of the encampment began moving tents around and created one section of the yard that was a little more fortified. And they also called on Harvard students to come and support them. And when the administrators came to check IDs, the students refused to submit to those ID checks, and administrators just walked away. Later on in the day, protesters raised a Palestinian flag on the flagpole, which had not been flying, an American flag. The American flag gets taken down every afternoon. And administrators and Harvard Police Department officers came and took down the flag and also took down a canvas that protesters had put up with names of Palestinians killed in Gaza. They confiscated those items and went into University Hall. And a member of an administrator was filming students. It's unclear if that's going to result in disciplinary action.
Okay. And we are here with Joe Lemon, who is a reporter for the Harvard Crimson, and our own Max Larkin of WBUR. And in this portion of the show on Radio Boston, we are getting as up-to-date as we can an understanding of what is happening now on the Harvard and MIT campuses with student protests and their reactions. So part two now. Max Larkin, I'll come back to you. Response from students who are not participating in the encampments. So, for example, yesterday was the day observing Israel independence. Tell me what we know about pushback from other students, anything that you can tell me about anything that might have happened yesterday in response, counter protests, students who don't like the encampments, just a little bit of context, anything we can give.
Yeah, I mean, you have to imagine that there are some students, mainly students, you know, taking part in sort of Israeli-American alliance groups, students with a strong connection to Israel, maybe Israeli students themselves, who hear these chants, for instance, from the river to the sea or globalize the intifada, and I think very reasonably imagine violence and are cast back into some of the brutal struggle over that particular you know, patch of land over the course of the last 75 years. And so you did have students, you know, you have a pretty reliable counter-protest. Israeli flags hung on the periphery of the MIT encampment. When that encampment was briefly vacated on Monday, you had some of those students going in and on video taking signs apart. Because I think authentically they see it as sort of a locus of hate or anti-Semitism. But so far, you know, there's been very, very little nationally violence originating from these camps, and the violence indeed has seemed to originate more reliably from the counter-protests that follow them.
And on the Harvard campus, Joe Lemon, what can you tell us? I do know that there is at least one lawsuit from some students and alum concerned about how Harvard is responding and protecting Jewish students on campus. What else can you tell us?
Yeah, well, in terms of the encampment itself, so the people who would be mainly affected would be Harvard freshmen. They are the ones who live in the yard. The Crimson recently reported they spoke to more than 40 Harvard freshmen, and freshmen did not report significant disturbances. That goes against what Dean of Students Thomas Don had written in an email saying that he had heard reports of students being disturbed, as well as the president of the Harvard Hillel sent an email saying that some Jewish students had felt disturbed and some had even gone to stay in hotels instead of staying in their rooms. But In the Crimson's reporting, the general sentiment among the freshmen was that it was not a significant disturbance.
I'm going to play a little sound here of what MIT student Sam Innes told WBUR on Monday about why he joined the protests.
MIT owes it to the world to end our research as it relates to such violent action. On top of that, as a Jewish student, I feel a personal connection to this cause, and especially with the popular sentiment that these camps are so anti-Semitic and make the campus a less safe place for Jewish students. I really feel like I need to come out and showcase that that is not the case.
And Max Larkin, the reason I wanted to play that cut is to underscore the complexity of this moment. Sometimes in trying to tell the story or in putting sound out or having a limited amount of time, I don't know if all of the complexity comes out. And in that sound, we hear the full complexity of what it seems to be happening on the campuses.
Yeah, I was at, during a particularly well-coordinated counter-protest, I was at MIT's encampment late last week, I think on Friday. And as I arrived, anti-Zionist Jewish students were leading the encampment members in Hebrew prayers and songs. And I think we are getting a richer picture of what's happening in these camps. You know, there are those chants. Don't want to deny their existence. But there also was at MIT and at Northeastern kind of a general air of welcome, teaching, feeding people. They had an herb garden, their dogs and kids inside. And then I think people are kind of coming to see that these sorts of protests have been quite common. I will cop to the fact that in 2011, I set up a tent in the same spot where Harvard's encampment is now for a much less kind of controversial or hefty cause. And I spoke to Mary Bassett, now on the faculty of Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, but she was also once a camping, occupying Radcliffe undergraduate. She spoke about her own protest in the 70s. Here's what she said.
We occupied Massachusetts Hall because of Harvard University's investment in golf. And we had dialogue with the administration, and we were not punished. The outcome of it was completely different.
So today, Bassett, after a long and storied career, is one of 350 Harvard professors who, as of this morning, had signed a letter calling on President Alan Garber to have what they called a candid, constructive dialogue with camp members in this case as well.
So I'm going to stay with you, Max Larkin. Joe, your reporting is very valuable, so stay with me. But Max, I'm going to stay with you, and I will note we're spending the whole hour on this. We will look more at the history of protests on our campuses here in the area, the differences between now and then. That's later in the show. Max, I want to put these two encampments in the context of what has happened in some other places, from negotiated outcome at Brown to a nonviolent, non-negotiated outcome at Tufts, to police involvement from the state police at Northeastern to the Boston police at Emerson. We've got a whole range of how things have turned out, Max.
We have, yeah. And it's sort of fascinating. The president of Wesleyan University in Connecticut said they're breaking the rules, but they seem to be content to accept the consequences. So far, there have been no consequences. And as long as they're not disrupting the fundamental work, safety, smooth functioning of the university, I'm prepared to let them stay. And I thought that was a very interesting stance, more in keeping with what I'm used to.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, have you spoken with any students in the last 24 hours participating in the encampment?
I haven't spoken directly to students.
Okay, so is there a sense, I'm trying to figure out how to ask this in a way that as a journalist you can answer it. Have you any credible information about sort of the trajectory of where this is going in terms of peaceful outcome versus not peaceful outcome? Or is that just pure speculation and you can't do it as a student journalist?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that would be speculation. There is no evidence right now that there's anything nonviolent that would happen. And, you know, we're coming up on commencement. That's sort of the thing on the horizon to keep in mind. Commencement is on the 23rd. and students lose undergraduates lose access to their housing on the 12th.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sort of the deadlines to keep in mind with this.
And Joe, I just want to clarify, you said there's no evidence that anything nonviolent would happen, which means you're suggesting there's no evidence that it won't end in violence. I just want to clarify, is that what you're saying?
I'm just saying that there hasn't been any violence so far, and I just have no reason to say that there would be.
Okay, and Max Larkin, what do we all watch for in the next 24 to 48 hours? The biggest open question right now is X.
I think there, 350 Harvard professors is a lot of Harvard professors. They do not perhaps wield the influence that they might at another campus or in another era. But you heard it in Mary Bassett's voice. We have seen generations of student protests before. Why not try it now? That seems to be the big dangling question here.
All right. Now, Max Larkin, you're going to stay with us. Joe Lemon, thank you so much, of the Harvard Crimson, a sophomore who is getting such an education in journalism now. Thank you for joining us to tell us more.
Thank you so much for having me on.
You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are continuing our conversation about encampments on local college campuses protesting the war in Gaza. Still with us, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, and we're going to add three new voices now. Here in studio two, Harlene Singh, director of the Women's Studies Research Center and senior associate provost for faculty and global affairs at Brandeis University. Welcome back, Harlene.
Thank you, Tiziana. So happy to be here.
I'm glad to have you here. On the line, Joan Donovan, founder of the Critical Internet Studies Institute and assistant professor of journalism and emerging media studies at Boston University. And just to note that Boston University holds the license for WBUR. Joan, welcome back to you as well.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. And in the Zoom room, Kelly Carter-Jackson, associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Kelly Carter-Jackson, welcome back to you too.
Thanks. Hi there.
So we've got everybody at the table. Here's how I'd like to do this. For this next piece of our conversation, I'd like to focus on where we are with protest today. And I've got two main questions. The first one that I'm going to ask you, and Max is going to sit tight for a couple of minutes, the three of you, the three faculty members, the first question is, what has this moment taught you about where our society is today when it comes to protest? And Harlene, I'm looking eye to eye with you, so I'm going to start with you.
Well, Tiziana, I mean, you said we have to focus on today, but I think I want to start by acknowledging that I wouldn't be a free person, and you nor I would have the vote if it weren't for protests and civil disobedience. And I think it's, you know, as much as we want to talk about today, I think it's very important to put that history in context here. I think today, we are focused, of course, on the issue at hand since October 7th, and you and I have been in conversation about this before as well. But I think it's very important for us also to think about what the young people are saying when they are out protesting. Often a protest, a moment of resistance is rarely just about that moment, but it is also giving voice to a larger frustration, a larger disaffectation, I think, with what we have at hand. And for students these days, you know, how are our institutions actually serving them? What are they getting from education? Where are they going with this education? And I think part of it is that we cannot educate them about the world, politics, history, what it means to be a human being, and then ask them not to speak up when they want to.
Joan Donovan of Boston University, I'll come to you next. Either picking up from Harlene or beginning again at the top of the question, what has this moment taught you about where our society is today when it comes to protest?
Yeah, I think it's been really heartening to see students caring about world issues, considering that, you know, a lot of these young people have just been through some seriously damaging life, world historic events with the pandemic. And so part of it is that, you know, the kids are paying attention and they do care about things beyond themselves, beyond, you know, selfies and the kind of reputation they get for being heavy social media users. So I think what it's really taught me is also the way in which internet and social media have broadened students' horizons about their placement in the world and their duty to others. And part of that, I really think, is the actual work of education. You can talk about, read about, see videos of, but there's really nothing more visceral than the experience of what these students are going through, which is being told they don't have a voice. The other thing I've learned is that administrators really see themselves as an arm of the state. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we have campus police. There's a reason why policies are not laws. And students are really picking up on that hypocrisy of saying, you know, you can learn all these things about history in class, but don't for a second think that your civil disobedience will be met with a rational discussion or, you know, a reflection on what's really happening, which is, I think that students have a really important say in, you know, are these universities or are they corporations? Are they behaving like hedge funds that offer classes? And the transparency argument, I don't think administrators have a leg to stand on.
So let's bring in Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley there, who was seconding some of what you were saying, Joan Donovan. Kelly Carter Jackson, jump in.
Yeah, I couldn't echo that anymore. I mean, one of the questions I think we have to ask ourselves is, what is the role of the university? What is the role of higher education? These students are coming to learn. And in learning, they discover all kinds of ideas about the world and their politics. Their whole identity is being shaped in this short 4-5-ish year period. And I think that we have forgotten about the role of activism and what it's supposed to do. You know, just last week I was at Roxbury Community College, and there's a massive banner that says, without activism, you'd be driving on the highway right now. And as I was driving by that sign, I almost stopped.
Just for context, Roxbury organized to prevent a highway from coming straight through that part of Boston in the late 1960s. And it was a galvanizing moment for Roxbury. Sorry, Kelly Carter Jackson, go ahead.
Yeah, activism has been essential in the progress that we all live in today. You know, I'm a graduate of Columbia University. When I think about the protests of 1968, I think about how, because of those protests, there are now more Black faculty at Columbia. There are now more Black students at Columbia. That gym that they were trying to build in Morningside Heights was not built because of activism. And I think of the fact that the administration has almost always never been on the right side of history when it comes to student protests. And if they're not careful, they're going to be on the wrong side again.
So I'm going to add one more voice on that note. Juliet Kayyem is faculty chair of the Homeland Security and Security and Global Health Projects at the Harvard Kennedy School. And here she is speaking to Commonwealth Beacons, the podcast.
I'm not sure what the benefit is of mocking students. Look, are there going to be people who don't know what they're fighting for? Are there going to be people who are bad seeds? Certainly. These are not four-year-olds. Looking back at student protests 20 years later, they've generally been right. Maybe they didn't cause the end of the war in Vietnam, but they were expressing a sentiment that it took the U.S. government many years to realize. If you look at the civil rights movement, same.
So here's where we are. That was just Juliet Kayyem and that sound. We've got Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley, Harlene Singh of Brandeis, Joan Donovan of Boston University, WBUR education reporter Max Larkin is here with me. We are looking for this whole hour at Harvard, MIT, the protests happening there, and more broadly at what this tells us. Now, Kelly Carter Jackson, you said, the question is, what is the role of the university? That is where we will go a little later. I actually literally have that question written down, and I want to spend some time on it. So noted, and we will come back to it. And in a minute, I know what my next question is, but I want to turn to Max Larkin for a minute. And Max, you might be like, nah, I'm all good. But I want to give you a chance to react to what you've heard so far or ask any other questions if they've come up for you.
Yeah, I totally agree, and with all that's been said. I mean, notionally, a democracy depends on people's ability to, you know, raise a complaint, try to move the needle. And these universities have become so large and so enmeshed in the global economy and with governments. Is it okay if I go to my cut here, Tiziana?
Yes, do it.
Yeah, so I spoke to Dorothea Makri, who is at the MIT encampment taking part in it. She's a doctoral student in physics there. And her argument is, we have done this before, this divestment thing. Can we take a listen to that?
The day after the invasion of Ukraine, MIT cut funding ties with Skoltek, which is a Russian university, within 24 hours. And we just want MIT to listen to students and workers and do the same. Like, why are we building killer drones for Israel? That's not something that should be going on MIT's campus.
That just made me reflect, Tiziana, on, you know, I think they anticipated that ties to the Russian government, to the Russian establishment, were going to be politically perilous and potentially compromising going forward. And so I think we all just have to make our own individual judgments about this separate war, which has been just as lethal, if not more so. Why and when it comes time to signal discontent that's clearly poll show broadly felt.
So I'm glad you ended right where you did, Max. So I'm turning back to you, Harleen Singh of Brandeis, because here's the other thing that's on my mind, especially I think, you know, I try to bring my whole self to the mic when I host, and I'm a mom of two college students, right? So I think about life on college campus for a young person who's got one foot in the adult world and one foot in the kid world. And I think about the kids and young adults for whom this is a deeply painful moment outside of the encampments. And, you know, I talked with Seth Moulton, U.S. Representative Seth Moulton, recently about what safety needs to mean in this moment, right? Given the high bar that there should be for pushing back on student voice, given everything the U faculty members have said. But how to think about students who are standing on the outside of this and finding this deeply painful about their identity, who they are, what they believe in, where they think they've come from. What is the obligation there to Harleen Singh?
Well, Tiziana, I mean, I think I introduced the term civil disobedience here.
You did.
And I want to go back to say the focus there needs to be on civil. What do we consider civil disobedience? When you deface property, when there's vandalism, when you make other people feel unsafe, when you create an environment that disrupts everybody else's life. I mean, on the one hand, you might look at it as something that you need to do in order to disrupt the status quo and have people pay attention to what you're doing. On the other hand, you are really stepping out of the lines, out of a social contract that has been created within which we live in our institutions, we live in our society, we live in our world. And at that point, I think we have to be both able as students, as adults, to be able to take responsibility for our actions, but also to realize what it is that we are disrupting. So for those students who are on the outside, right, I mean, we have a responsibility to both sides, the students who are protesting and the students who are not protesting. As a university, it is our first job to make everybody feel safe on campus. Most universities, we have really a clear set of guidelines in terms of where you can protest, where you can, what you can do and what you can't do. And when you step out of those guidelines, our first job as administrators and as a university is to be able to talk to the students, to educate them. I stand very firmly behind this, that, you know, you're talking about people having one foot in the adult world, one foot in the kid world, so to speak. On the other hand, I think we as teachers need to remember that our job is first to educate people, not to put in punitive measures.
Joan Donovan, Kelly Carter Jackson, I'm going to come to you in just a second. I'm going to play a little bit of sound here. Rotem says she is a Harvard alumnus who lives on campus but did not want to provide her last name to WBUR. We did, in this case, make a choice to use this sound. She says she's concerned about hatred spreading on campus in the name of free speech. She says the true entity to blame is Hamas. Here is Rotem's sound.
But nobody here on campus seems to condemn what they have been doing, mm-hmm. or to, you know, try to get to a reasonable resolution that does not involve ethnic cleansing of Jews from of Israelis from their homeland. Mm-hmm. And I just wish that we here on Harvard could sit down and actually talk on stuff without all these this. What's going on and the hatred.
So I think I'll come to you next, Kelly Carter Jackson. The reason I wanted to play that cut was the sitting down and talking piece. Mm-hmm. And that can mean two things. And I want to note that I get that, right? One mm-hmm. could be genuine dialogue at a place of learning. And I am co-opting Rotem's point now when I say one could read that as can't we all just get along as well. Mm-hmm. I recognize both of those things, Kelly Carter Jackson. Mm-hmm. And now I turn it respectfully in all senses to you.
I think that these conversations and these protests are exactly what students are trying to achieve across the board. That I think as a whole, most students are willing to engage in these hard conversations and understand that things are complicated and complex and that there can be a both and. And I think that oftentimes we put way too much attention on the outliers, on the bad actors, on the people that come in to dominate and shout over and use hate speech. And then I often think that the media runs with that, and that becomes the story. I have seen more stories about what I think are bad actors and outliers than the stories that to me have been absolutely beautiful, which is seeing, you know, Muslim students and Jewish students hand in hand, singing, arm in arm, you know, making space for Jewish students to have their Passover and a Seder. You saw that at Columbia University. Making space for people to feel.
We saw that here. I want to know.
And Saw that here. And I think that that message of community, of embrace, of inclusion is one that needs to be shouted at the hilltops. And that is not, I think, what has been a dominant thread throughout these conversations. And I wish people knew about that more, because I really do genuinely believe that there are more people willing to have the hard conversations and hear one another out and to talk about grievances and to talk about the history of these two groups of people and to be able to have meaningful, impactful conversations without creating or causing harm.
Joan Donovan.
Yeah, I think also what's happening here is there were many, many months of vigils and rallies and discussions that culminated in this, what sociologists call tactical innovation, right? And so you have your speak outs on the library steps, you know, from 12 to 2, and, you know, but it doesn't disrupt in the way that an encampment does. So an encampment is a kind of persistent technique that students have adopted to call attention to, you know, the what's happening in Gaza. And one thing that's been really interesting about that is the way these encampments are set up. They have a media committee, they have certain message discipline around returning the conversation to Gaza. And what I see, what Kelly was noting as well, is this media focus on, well, let me identify one or two bad apples and not follow the actual train of conversation and discussion that the students are laying out. I think there's also, you know, when it comes to safety and students on campus, I believe as a professor that you can't really learn in an environment where you don't feel safe. And there's reasons why you go to college and you have a housing and a meal plan. And, you know, it's a really transitionary time for a lot of folks. And all of the things that feel out of step can feel scary no matter, you know, who you are, because it's something new. And my hope is that as students develop a sense of, well, what is possible, you know, these encampments for me really resemble a kind of field trip into history. You know, people are teaching. It's almost like an idyllic version of a university where they have programming all day, free lectures, libraries. But unfortunately, I do think that when it comes to students who are perhaps at the university to fulfill a credential in order to get to the next stage in their career, they might be really missing out on the practical skills that one learns when organizing for a greater cause. And
yeah,
I'm hoping that there's a way that the students who do feel unsafe can also find a place and a space to talk about what it is that they're upset about. I've heard a lot. Well,
I'm actually going to stop you there, Joan, just because we need to take a quick pause. You're listening to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are having a conversation about how our campuses here have responded to protests and what we can learn. With us, WBUR's Max Larkin, Joan Donovan of Boston University, Harleen Singh of Brandeis University, and Kelly Carter Jackson of Wellesley. I'm going to skip the titles now to save time. And Joan and Donovan and Kelly Carter Jackson had set us up for our next question, which is, okay, so what is the role of the university? And given our understanding of that, what needs to happen now? Quick question to you, Max Larkin, in reporting on this, all the way back from October 7th forward, is that a conversation you've heard come into the mix from administrators on campuses? Has there been an awareness actively, or is that something we're becoming aware of sort of now as we step back?
Yeah, I think there is a discussion, certainly at Harvard, where it was battling confused statements. That was so much the story in the immediate aftermath of the Hamas attack. Should the university be taking a stand at all about whether these deaths are tragic or the ensuing deaths are equally tragic? And Claudine Gay, forced out as president, took a position that seemed to satisfy no one. And then the political atmosphere built up and up around that, and one had to pity her and her team by the end of that experience.
Technically, she resigned.
Yes. But with the board's approval.
Yeah.
I think what I see as the through line here is that, I was at that counter protest. There were people waving Israeli flags on dowels. The whole thing felt a little tense, heavy police presence. And for those people, the people in the encampment were seen as proxies for Hamas, who inflicted this terrible attack. And I think at times, Arab American students in particular have seen those people waving those flags as themselves a threat, proxies for Israel. Some of them have lost dozens of family members in this war. And so I think one thing that I see more and more faculty talking about is, can't the university help teach both sides to see through that kind of schematic, nationalistic kind of maniac thinking and see that there's a complicated process path toward peace or at least understanding here?
So, Harleen Singh, I'm going to turn to you now from Brandeis. Our questions are, how are colleges and universities supposed to serve students? What do colleges and universities have to do differently or better with that in mind? And I'll tell you, Joan Donovan and Kelly Carter Jackson, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to get as much of the three of you in as I can. Harleen Singh.
Thank you, Tiziana, for that. I think it's really important for us. You said, what is the role of the university? I think the role of the university first is to educate people. But what education does then is empowers people to make their own choices. That we cannot regulate. When you educate people and they make their own choices, they will speak up for what they want to speak up for and not necessarily toe the line about what may be correct, politically or right or wrong. And I think we've become really focused on the idea of what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad, what kind of political stand makes sense right now and not. And I think education is that place where this question of, you mentioned earlier whether students are feeling unsafe. And I want to make the distinction there about being unsafe and uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because a lot of education makes us uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It asks questions that we are not always ready to answer. So I think it's very important for us as we talk about education to make that distinction between unsafe and uncomfortable. Because education, when done right, should make us uncomfortable.
Kelly Carter Jackson.
That's so well put. I agree with all of that. I think that there's a difference between safety and discomfort. I also think that there's a difference between what is a crime and what is harmful. And I think oftentimes when we think about this encampment, the first sort of thing is to say, well, this is illegal. Well, a bigger question is it harmful? And I think that's something that I've looked at the president at Wellesley who said, yes, by our bylaws, this encampment is not lawful. However, these students are not causing harm. These students are voicing their opinion. These students are trying to reckon with the moment in which they're living in. And that supersedes, the law or policy in that instance. And I think we need to really think about those things. What's difficult with education is that And having these conversations, it's very easy to say right, wrong, good, bad. But most of our educational experience is incredibly complicated and nuanced. And nuance is not a soundbite. Nuance is not something that you can just throw in as a one-liner and sort of cover, you know, a multitude of explanations. We really need to sort of tease out this history, these ideas, these interactions. And that can't really be encapsulated in a headline or in a picture. And I think that's one of the things that's really frustrating is that we have all of these headlines and images that are supposed to be shorthand for histories that are complicated and are nuanced and are old and deep and wide. And it's just difficult to do that on a large stage, which is why the classroom is so instrumental.
Joan Donovan.
Yeah, as I'm hearing people, I do agree that it's the role of the administrators and the faculty to understand when students are truly at risk or that there are unsafe conditions. And I've been watching very closely what happened at UCLA, where for several nights, the encampment was attacked by pro-Israel vigilantes who would show up after midnight with loudspeakers, fireworks, chemical agents like bear mace, and would try to tear down the encampment while the police looked on. And Chancellor Balk eventually allowed the LAPD and the LA Sheriff's Office to come in and arrest students. And I think that this understanding of where the university is that the students do pay to be there. And as a result, this idea that they're somehow playing or that they don't really know what they're doing. I think the faculty especially have a responsibility to step in and say, well, you know, the students have been expressing these thoughts for a long time now. And these students are at the end of their semester and the end of the academic year, and they're putting a tremendous amount on the line to call attention to an atrocity. And for many of the students that I talk to, they'll say things like, I don't object to what Israel is, I object to what they're doing, right? And in some ways, I think the students are getting a really interesting education in what counts as anti-Semitism, what counts as racism, and how to have those nuanced conversations around state power and the difference between that and prejudice and hatred of a group of people.
The other thing the other thing that you're drawing out, Joan Donovan, and the way that I'll frame it here, and Max Larkin, in a minute I'm going to turn to you. I'm also going to play a little more sound before I turn to you. You know, Kelly Carter Jackson had talked about nuance. Harleen Singh, you talked about, you know, students are going to speak out because we're teaching them to form opinions. You know, you might not always like those opinions, but also tensions around definitions, who believes what, who interprets what, where, and all of that complexity and how hard it is, especially in, you know, sort of the typed moments of the media, for example, to pull all of that out. There is one other cut I'm going to throw in here that picks up on some of the other themes we've just heard from the three of you. One more from Juliette Kayyem here, faculty chair of the Homeland Security and Security and Global Health Projects at Harvard Kennedy School, speaking on Commonwealth Beacons, the podcast.
Part of it is the colleges and universities defining what the behavior is that is acceptable. But if you say no conduct is acceptable, that's the kind of reaction you're going to get. And it's inconsistent with all the other protests that they've allowed for everything from gay rights to the pro-gun lobby. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But obviously, given the sensitivities of this issue and the camps, people are not seeing this rationally.
One of the things that has begun to emerge, Max Larkin, is a conversation about, is there consistency? What should universities as universities do? You talked about early on in this, in your reporting, you know, universities beginning to say, should we be neutral, et cetera? We've got Congress involved in this now. Is there an arc toward agreement visible now, or are we up in the air based on what you're seeing for a while?
I think certainly there probably has been some deep institutional soul searching about whether and when official public statements are required of a university president. I think the bigger question that I think still remains is, a given university, any of the ones we've discussed today, is going to have a sizable Jewish enrollment. That's the nature of American demographics. Increasingly, though, I can't think of a school where I've asked around and they didn't have a Palestinian student as well. And so basically the conflict is alive in your school in some ways, and I've certainly seen it at Brandeis. Universities have become also so large that they become in some ways, maybe divided inwardly. Brandeis has this fabulously progressive history, but of course, people who were grieving deeply after October 7th. How is that playing out?
Probably last word to you, Harlene, just so you know.
Well, that's Harlene a heavy Singh. Order.
Yeah. Sorry.
not at all. I think, you mentioned earlier about being rational about these things, the complexity of this. You know, you've have people, communities, histories on all sides that have been under siege, if not for decades, then for centuries. To expect that people will be rational about this, I think, is actually something that that's just too idealistic. People are not going to be rational about this. And so I think our job as a society, as administrators, or as a university, is to find the right way forward. It is not necessarily to just find out which is the rational way forward. I mean, and in that, the complexity of this is never going to be teased out. We've been doing this for hundreds of years.
Yeah, I just want to say, I think faculty have played this beautiful role in places. There were MIT faculty with pink armbands de-escalating at that counter-protest. Mm-hmm. Walter Johnson at Harvard saying, we can have serious criticisms of the Israeli state. We will not be anti-Semitic. We will not tolerate that at Harvard. Mm-hmm. And I just give all the credit in the world to the three teachers in this conversation.
And on that note, I wish we could go another hour. I cannot tell you how grateful I am. And Max, just chef's kiss to you for that ending. WBUR education reporter Max Larkin, Harlene Singh, director of the Women's Studies Research Center and senior associate provost for faculty and global affairs at Brandeis University, Joan Donovan, founder of the Critical Internet Studies Institute and assistant professor of journalism and emerging media studies at Boston University, and Kelly Carter Jackson, associate professor of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Cannot thank you enough. Thank you for being here. Mm-hmm.